Okay, we are on we're on the citation from Schiffman number 78 in our list, which is page 152, where he starts talking about Paul. And you'll see in my citations list, I have in red, both citations assume the Christian reading of Paul and the early followers. Schiffman reads the text from the perspective of the church. And as I mentioned before we got started today, that was not too surprising because quite a few recognized Jewish scholars seem to read Paul as though he were a Christian. So with that in mind, we'll still look at what he has to say about Paul. He, Paul, also encouraged the notion of abandoning the law. This literary legacy greatly intensified anti-Jewish notions in the New Testament. And of course, remember, Schiffman's book was written quite a few years ago. There are a whole number of scholars today who would object to what Schiffman had to say, me included, because I don't believe Paul at any point encouraged abandoning the law. But I do think that since we've already done Mark Nanos and Zetterholm's book, we should recognize that there's quite a split in academic understanding of Paul about where he actually stood in terms of the Gentile relationship to the law because of his apocalyptic background. So this citation I left in because we want to recognize what Schiffman's perspective is, because it's going to shape how he views what happens in the tradition of the first century. So let's look at the next citation. As we trace the history of the New Testament traditions, they move from disputes with the Pharisees, scribes, and other chief priests to polemics against the Jews and Judaism, from the notion of some Jews as enemies of Jesus to the demonization of Jewish people as a whole. Now, that is true if we read church history, but I don't believe that that's true if we read New Testament documents. It is absolutely true that one of the New Testament scholars said, if the New Testament is in fact anti-Semitic, it's horrible. But if it's actually anti-Jewish, it's not only horrible, it's a tragedy because there isn't any New Testament then. So here's the whole point. If we read out the Jewish background of the New Testament, we're going to end up with a Christian religion that's anti-Semitic and essentially anti-Semitic. It's not an accident. It's the basis of the church is to stand in opposition to Judaism. That's the only way the church can identify itself, okay? The church becomes the church because it abandons Jewish principles. If that weren't the case, then it would just be another form of Judaism, as Paul suggests. So that means that Schiffman takes the view that the church is not only anti-Semitic, but anti-Jewish. And of course, a lot of academics view it that way until you come up with Friedrichsen and Zetterholm and Nanos who start poking holes in that and say, wait a minute, that's not how the text reads. That's how the tradition reads. Okay, so let's continue. Schiffman next says, in addition, the Tannaim enacted laws designed to further separate Jewish Christians from the community by prohibiting commerce and certain other interrelationships with them. Of course, I would modify that. I would say that they enacted laws designed to further separate Jewish messianic believers, because there aren't any Jewish Christians in the first century. In fact, I'm not sure that there ever were any Jewish Christians, because by the time you get to the notion of Christian, you're well into the second and third century. And then the Gentiles are taking over what becomes the Christian church. But nevertheless, the Tannaim did in fact recognize that Messianic believers in the Jewish congregations or in the Jewish synagogues represented a different interpretive scheme for the same texts. And therefore they, according to Schiffman, started prohibiting things between relationships between Orthodox Judaism and Messianic Jewish believers. But the real turn came with the Bar Kokhba revolt. And you see in the next citation, the Bar Kokhba revolt, 132 to 135 CE. Now, this is important that you recognize the dates, because this is almost a full generation after the last of the disciples, John. Okay? So it takes almost a full generation. By the way, the chief Jewish spokesperson at this time is Akiva, right? It takes almost a full generation after the last of the apostolic material is written for this revolt to occur, which, by the way, doesn't begin with, isn't motivated by religious ideas. It's a tax revolt, okay? All kinds of history behind that. You can look at Gager's book, The Origins of Antisemitism, and he'll show you that it's political and social uprising, not religious, that starts this revolt, okay? But notice what Schiffman says. The Tannaim outlawed the writings of the early Christians, okay? So obviously it's not the early Christians. They outlawed the writings of the Messianic Jewish followers of Yeshua, declaring that Torah scrolls or texts with divine names copied by Messianic Jewish believers in Yeshua had no sanctity. Okay, so by now, here's what's really happening. Akiva names the leader of the Bar Kokhba revolt as the Messiah. And of course, the Jewish believers in the synagogues who accepted Yeshua as the Messiah could not endorse Akiva's view, since Akiva was the principal interpreter of Jewish thinking at the time. It created a religious rift, which actually ended up to be a political rift, because when the Bar Kokhba revolt failed to establish Israel as an independent nation again, 135, and the Romans came back and severely punished the Jews who were involved in the Bar Kokhba revolt, those Jews turned on the Messianic believers, saying, "You are responsible for our failure because you didn't assist us and you didn't support us in our revolt." And of course, they would answer, "But we couldn't, because Akiva named someone who wasn't the Messiah." At this point, of course, the separation is almost fully in place because Gentiles are already working against the Jewish foundation of the Messianic community. And the two split over political issues about the war, about the revolt. And the result is that the Messianic congregations or assemblies leave the Orthodox synagogues and vice versa. And the separation then starts to move in the direction of a separate Gentile religion. We call that now, 2,000 years later, Christians. But of course, in the time that it happened, they weren't calling themselves Christians. They were Messianic believers in the Yeshua as the Messiah. Okay? So, now number 82. To the rabbis. They were not Jews with incorrect views about the Messiah, but Gentiles who claimed to be the true Israel. And of course, this is later, because now you get supersessionism. You get the idea that the early church fathers promulgated, which was the true Israel was the Israel that believed in Yeshua, Jesus, as the Messiah. And as a result of that, the early church fathers claimed that the original hereditary Jewish population was no longer in God's favor, and that's what causes all the anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic literature to be printed. Okay, so now he says, Schiffman, the Emperor Nerva, right at the end of the apostolic period, freed the Christians, probably including Jewish Christians, from paying the fiscus Judaicus. But what you really want to read is he freed the Gentiles who were claiming to be followers of the Messiah, including Jews who claimed the same thing, from the fiscus Judaicus, which was a tax, a Jewish capitation tax decreed as a punishment in the aftermath of the revolt, the tax revolt of 6673, right? Clearly, the Romans now regarded the Christians as a separate group, but we could read that. Clearly, now the Romans regarded the Gentiles who were propagating this new religion as a separate group, because Orthodox Judaism was still, still contained Jews who believed that Yeshua was the Messiah within the synagogues. Okay. The way, but Schiffman is right, the way was paved for the legitimization of Christianity as a licit religion. But that doesn't happen for almost another 200 years. Okay. So there's a lot of flux going on here that we need to be cognizant of, that Schiffman does not include in his analysis. Okay? Let's go to the next citation. At some point, probably connected with the Christianization of the empire in the fourth century, you see what he's just said? The Fiscus Judaicus from the previous citation under Nerva was in 100 CE, but the Christianization of the empire comes after Constantine in the fourth century, right? 200 or 300 years later. The Christians, and now he's right, they're now called Christians, began to approach their Jewish neighbors with much greater antagonism, especially in the Byzantine Palestine, okay? Physical attacks against the Jews and their households of worship were not unknown in this period. That's right. The first pogroms begin in the 3rd and 4th centuries, whereas in earlier times there had been coexistence and harmony. By the 5th century, do you see this? So now we're 400 years past the end of the apostolic period. Much anti-Semitic legislation had been enacted. Jews were forbidden for building synagogues, studying the oral law. The Jews were now called Christ killers, and anti-Judaism was the norm in Christian preaching. Of course, you can think of Tertullian, Chrysostom, Origen, all of these early church fathers who latch onto the idea, by the way, they have a vested interest in this, latch onto the idea that Christianity is no longer merely an extension of Judaism, a sect of the way, as Paul calls it, but is now a separate religion in opposition to Judaism and identifies itself as the new Israel. All of that stuff is happening in the first 300 years after the end of the apostolic period. Okay?
So Skip, would you say that Christianity caused anti-Semitism?
Yes, let's back up. There are four different topics when it comes to anti-Semitism. The first is, of course, anti-Hebraic views. You find that in Egypt because they were against the Hebrews, right? Then you find anti-Judaism, anti-Semitism, and we have to distinguish those two. Anti-Semitism literally means against all Semites. And of course, today that would include all Arabs and anybody who comes out of that, you know, that ethnic background. Okay. Today, of course, anti-Semitism is the equivalent of anti-Judaism. But what really happens is anti-Judaism is is another step. It's not, now I'm no longer against Hebrews. Now I'm against Jews. And so what really happens when most of these scholars talk about anti-Semitism, they're really talking about anti-Judaism, because obviously in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, there aren't any Muslims, so you can't be anti-Semitic in that sense. You can only be anti-Jewish. Okay? So as far as Rome is concerned, enacting legislation against the Arabs, because as far as they're concerned, that, and it's true, it doesn't even exist. So their view of anti-Semitic is really anti-Jewish. And that's what we need to correct that when we read Schiffman, because we're not talking about against all ethnic Semitic groups. We're talking about against Jewish groups in particular, right?
Is this when replacement theology came in?
This is the beginning of replacement theology. Supersessionism, that the church replaces Israel as the favorite of God, it begins here. And it's promulgated by the church itself, because the church is literally responsible for anti-Jewish sentiment. Okay? It's not responsible for anti-Hebraic ideas. That goes all the way back to Egypt. And it's not responsible for anti-Semitic ideas when it comes to the larger ethnic groups that we have today. But the church is responsible for anti-Jewish thinking, because it uses anti-Judaism to establish its own identity. Okay? That doesn't. What I'm not saying is that I'm not saying that the New Testament is anti-Jewish. I'm saying that the church is, and the interpreters of the church and the early church fathers read the New Testament as anti-Jewish.
Because if you even go to England in the medieval times, you know, that whole period,
yes.
I mean, they called Jews, they ate children and they, you know, all kinds of stuff like that.
Yes. And in medieval times, the church has already had approximately 500 or 600 years of teaching replacement theology, anti-Semitism, anti-Judaism. And so they got all that background going. And you can see it. I mean, if you come to Parma, I can take you to the Duomo, which was built in the beginning of the Duomo was 1300. And I can show you reliefs on the wall, which depict exactly this idea. Right. But it's inside the church that this is happening. And of course, inside the church in the Middle Ages was the same as inside the political empire, because the Holy Roman Empire was the politics and the economics and the religion of Europe. Okay.
Do you think they really believed it like those church fathers, or they propagated it because it was really benefited what they wanted for the?
I think it was, I think that they believed it, and it was convenient because it gave them justification, right? Let's continue with Shipman, because he's going to continue to talk about this, right? There is no evidence for the synagogue as an institution in Palestine before the first century CE. The synagogue, mentioned in Greek manuscripts in the diaspora of Hellenistic times, was not a prayer area, but rather the organization that managed the affairs of the local Jewish community. But here, I believe, Shiffman is too limited in his definition of synagogue. If you mean by synagogue a Jewish house of worship, then he's correct. Okay? But even in the first century, a synagogue wasn't a Jewish house of worship. A synagogue was a community center, because the politics and the social interaction and the religious worship all occurred in the synagogue, right? And that idea goes way back much earlier than the first century. If we only talk about the synagogue as a separate Jewish worship center, then he's right. There's no evidence before the first century. But that's because the Greek word synagoge comes into play in the first century as a religious term, not as a, you know, not as a civic term, right? It's ekklesia that's the civic term, as you know, and that's why Paul chooses it instead of synagoge, because synagoge is also a word for the, you know, the worship of Zeus, the worship of Diana, etc., right? So Shiffman has to be more careful here. He has to distinguish a religious assembly from a civic assembly. Let's continue. Teniatic Judaism provided the best means for the adaptation of the tradition to the new reality without temple and without sacrifice. Okay, so what time period are we talking about? If it's without temple and without sacrifice, clearly it has to be after 70 AD, and Teniatic Judaism continued until about 200 CE, right? Amoratic Judaism followed Taniatic. Okay, so what's the difference? Taniatic Judaism is the period of the teachers. This is the period where Judah the prince begins to write down the Talmud, where there's a massive shift in what it means to be Jewish from temple to study and prayer, and where instruction in Torah really becomes instruction in the study of the Talmud. And all of that happens between 70 AD and 200 AD. And it sets the stage for a complete remake of Judaism. Okay? Judaism today is not, and Judaism in the year 200, it's not the kind of Judaism that Yeshua experienced when he was doing his ministry in Galilee. It's absolutely changed, right? And it changed because the loss of the temple shifted the center of worship away from sacrifice and the presence of God in a particular location to the notion of study and prayer, as we're going to see. Shiffman talks a lot about this. So he says, This ability to adapt to the circumstances was made possible by the rabbi's unique approach to Jewish law. And this is important because Christine Hayes is going to talk about this a lot. The rabbi's unique approach to Jewish law, the notion of an oral law given at Sinai along with the written. Okay? In other words, Tanaitic Judaism claims that the oral law and the written law were given together at Moses' time on Sinai. Moses wrote down the written law, which we have in the Tanakh, but he passed on the oral law to the elders and then to Joshua and then on and on and on down through the ages. Okay? The point is, God gave both at the same time, which means that if I can find interpretation and reinterpretation in the Talmud about passages in the Tanakh, God gave those to Moses. So they have the same authority as the written Torah. Okay? So he says, the interpretation and reinterpretation of the Torah, which their approach allowed, brought about the unique combination of tradition and change which characterized Tanaitic Judaism. And by the way, as we mentioned last time, if you don't have a vehicle for flexibility, the religion ossifies and dies. So here, Tanaitic Judaism says, oh, but God already spoke about elevators and elevator buttons because it was already given to Moses 1,500 years earlier in oral form, and now we can elaborate and expand on it because whatever God gave to Moses, we're just elucidating now. It was already there, okay? It wasn't invented by us. It wasn't new. It was already given to Moses. It was already all-encompassing, okay? So let's continue. It's nice for Schiffman to say that in the next citation, Hebrew was very much a living language at this time. This is the Bar Kokhba revolt. And that, along with Aramaic and Greek, it served a large segment of the population. So it's nice to see that Schiffman doesn't buy the Christian idea that the spoken common language of Israel in the first century was Aramaic. No, it wasn't Aramaic. It was Hebrew and Aramaic and probably Greek. Okay? He goes on. As prayer had replaced sacrifice, okay, this is post-temple, post-second temple, right? As prayer has replaced sacrifice, Torah, in the form of the Mishnah, had now replaced messianism. A different kind of redemption was now at hand, okay? What kind of redemption is that? It's a redemption of study and prayer rather than worship and festival, right? In pre-exilic and in post-exilic before the destruction of the Second Temple times, the center of worship was Jerusalem in the temple. And the rituals of worship were the festivals. Okay? Now that's all gone. The Romans wiped out the temple and scattered the Jews. And it was a capital offense for a Jew to be found in Jerusalem. Okay? So what happens? Tanaitic Judaism replaces the temple and the festivals with the study of Torah, which becomes the study of Talmud, which becomes the yeshiva, and prayer. And what they add one more thing, which Schiffman doesn't talk about, and that is the giving of alms, charity. So prayer, study, and charity become the fundamentals of Judaism, right? What's lost, of course, is the focus on the worship at the temple, okay? But that was inevitable. The political environment doesn't allow it anymore. So there was enough flexibility given the oral Torah and Tanaitic Judaism to adapt to the new political environment that they faced. Okay, let's look at the next one. The fundamental change was that the oral Torah gradually evolved into a fixed corpus of its own. This is under Judah Nasi, Judah the Prince, about 200 CE, which eventually replaced the written Torah as the main object of Jewish study and guide for religious practice, at least for rabbinic Jews. That sentence tells you what happened in Judaism since the year 200 until the year 2100, until now, right? What happened is Judaism shifted from the written Torah to the oral Torah, now written in the Talmud, and the Talmud replaces the written Torah. That's why my Jewish rabbi friend here can say, when he went to yeshiva, they never even looked at the Torah. They studied the Talmud. Why? Because the Talmud becomes the main object of Jewish study and guide for practice. Right? Okay. Big, big change brought about by Rome's destruction of the temple. Okay, here we go. A final, fundamental difference has to do with the concept of an oral law. Phariseeism traced its non-biblical legal and exegetical traditions to the traditions of the fathers, or the unwritten laws. Yet nowhere do we find the Pharisees asserting that these traditions came from Sinai. The Tananim asserted that their extra-biblical traditions, many of them inherited from the Pharisees, were part of the oral law, a second Torah given by God to Moses at Sinai along with the written law. Okay? So do you see what's happened? The Tananim, the Pharisees didn't claim divine authority, divine Mosaic authority for their legal and exegetical traditions, right? They had traditions, washing of hands, et cetera, how you're supposed to eat, all they had the traditions, but they claimed that those were the traditions of the fathers handed down. They did not claim that they had divine authority from Moses himself and ultimately from God, okay? But by the time you get to the Tananim, 70 AD to 200 AD, right? What are they claiming? That these traditions are literally God's commandments given to Moses orally and passed down. So now they take as much authority as the written Torah itself and ultimately take precedence. Yes. Okay. Madeline, you had a question?
Yes, Skip. So in Yeshua's time, that was not the case yet. In Yeshua's time, it was still sacrifice, prayer, and the festivals.
Yeah, of course. And you'll notice that Yeshua's arguments with the Pharisees are not about the divine authority of the Pharisees' traditions, right? What does he say? He stood in the seat of Moses, says, listen to what they say, but don't act like they say. In other words, when they're interpreting the written Torah, you listen to what they have to say because that has divine authority. But the traditions are in flux, right? The traditions are, according to the house of Shema, according to the house of Akiva, depends on which, you know, who you're listening to. Hillel, Shammai disagreed on the tradition. So which one is right? Which one came from God, right? The Pharisees aren't arguing for divine authority, but 50 years later, 50 years after the death and resurrection of Yeshua, 50 years later, the Tananim are asserting that Moses got the oral Torah directly from God. And you can understand why they have to do that, right? Because the Sadducees are gone, the temple is gone, the whole fundamental structure of Judaism centered in the worship at the temple and the festivals has all been wiped away by the Romans, right? The Jews are scattered all over the diaspora, and now they have to rebuild. And they're rebuilding on the basis of the traditions, which now have to have authority, because nobody's going to follow the traditions if they think they're just made up by men. So they begin to assert that God gave them. Right?
So, Skip, does that mean, like, was it, like, a whole group of them that got together? Is a lot of people.
But the traditions had been handed down for centuries, right? The traditions, remember, the Pharisees have the traditions. They're just not claiming that they have divine authority, right? So the traditions are there. Look, go back and look at Yeshua's arguments with the Pharisees. They're usually about interpretive traditions, exegetical issues, or how people behave according to the tradition, okay? They're not inventing these. They're merely saying that, did you know that that tradition was given to Moses by God at Sinai? You thought it just came from your grandfather. But in fact, he knew that it came from Moses at Sinai, which means that it has as much authority as the Ten Commandments.
But But I mean, was there one specific rabbi that did it, or was it just a kind of
So the oral tradition was very flexible because it was handed down orally for centuries until Judah Nasi, Judah the Prince, wrote it down. And in about 200 CE, he took on the task of writing down what becomes the Talmud. But, and of course, when he wrote it down, it was standardized because he included the traditions that he believed came from Sinai, and he left out the ones that he didn't believe came from Sinai. Right? So once he writes it down, it becomes standard.
So up to that time, nothing was written down. Everything was passed on by oral and tradition. Everything was memorized. Everything was memorized. Except, of course,
you're talking only about the oral tradition. The written tradition was there, right? The written was already there.
They weren't allowed to write at one point, but he is the one that wrote it down. Because he realized that things were going to be forgotten, and he saw what was happening. I'm not defending it, or I'm just saying that's where it began, because he realized that people were being dispersed, and things would be forgotten. Not that he had it right.
I think it was more than just that things would be forgotten, because just like the Masoretes, and by the way, just like the apostles, if you don't write it down. You don't standardize it, right? If there's always an interpretive process going on, then how do you know, even if I remember it, that the next guy is going to say it exactly like I said it, right? So the point is, it's not just in a mnemonic device. It's not just a way to write it down so that it doesn't get forgotten. It's also a way to standardize it. Remember the Masoretes? They didn't just invent the text. The text was given to them. Handed down by tradition, right? But when they wrote it down, they included the vowel points. That standardizes the text. Now everybody reads it exactly the same way. Whereas before you could read exactly the same text differently. So Judah Nasi is doing the same thing. He's saying, wait a minute, it's possible that it'll be forgotten, so we have to write it down. But he also only includes those things that he believes are authoritative, which means that he selects which pieces of the tradition he's going to use, and by writing it down, he makes them the standard. Right?
And a lot of the things that people see as we think tradition, and you see what happens in a lot of the different Orthodox or / Jewish communities that are really not written down there. Well, they're written down now, but they become what is happening in that community. So it's that some of it's not across the board and across the world. So
that's they all have different ways of dealing with this. But the point is, up to about 200 CE, it was oral. It was flexible. It depended on which rabbi you followed. But once it gets written down, it takes on a different status. Okay, so let's continue, because this issue is going to come up big time when we get to the question about divine law. This is a huge issue for developing what becomes the divine law.
One more thing, Judah the Prince had the authority that people trusted what he wrote and took it as.
Yeah, this is a matter of somebody saying, who by the way did have authority, I'm going to do this, and the result is that he attracts those people who, you know, want a standardized text, right? Okay, let's go to the next part. The accuracy of the transmission of the teaching of both Torahs was seen to depend not only on the correctness of the contents, but also upon the mode of transmission. The Tananim make clear that to be considered authentic, a tradition must be translated in the same way that it was given at Sinai. Therefore, the written Torah had to be taught from a scroll, and the oral Torah had to be recited orally by a Tana, by an instructor. Okay? So until Judah the Prince writes it down, this was always communicated orally. Then he goes on. The various approaches to Judaism in the Second Temple period strove to provide the written law with an appropriate supplement to make it possible for Torah to serve as a genuine way of life in the Greco-Roman period. Okay? Now, I don't think that any Orthodox Jew would say that. But I believe that Schiffman is correct. That what happens is you can't live with a written document from the 15th century BCE and make it apply perfectly to the conditions of humanity in the first century, let alone the 21st century. You have to have the ability to create flexibility with the written material so that you can apply it to modern contemporary, whether it's first century or 21st century, issues, right? So this is the way that religions work. It's the same way that Islam works. It's the same way that Christianity works. It has to be flexible enough to be adaptable to the changes in human condition. And this is how the Jewish population was able to do that, right? I mean, think about it. The Torah, the written Torah, is fixed. It has a certain kind of social, political, historical boundary, right? I mean, people today don't boil their kids in a kid in his mother's milk. So whatever was going on there is fixed in that period of time. So I need to be able to adapt the verse, and I can adapt the verse through an oral exegetical process that gets handed down from tradition, from generation to generation. Okay, so Schiffman continues. It provided the basis for the assertion of continuity in Talmudic Judaism, an assertion maintained even in the face of numerous adaptations and adjustments. For in the view of the rabbis, there had been no change. All later developments had already been commanded as part of the Sinaitic revelation. In other words, there wasn't any change because Moses had been given all of it, even though it was given orally. So you couldn't go back and point to the written text and say, you know, but it doesn't talk about that. The point is that the oral text given to Moses talks about all of it. Right? Okay. So he says, the practical aspects of the need to determine an authoritative ruling led more and more towards standardization. Such a process never occurred in regard to the non-legal aspects of rabbinic tradition, the Agadah, the opinions, right? Hence, Agadah continued to demonstrate greater variety than did Halakha. Well, of course, because Agadah is my opinion about it. It's what do I think about it? In Christian circles is, what does it mean to me? That's the same as Agadah, right? Every believer can have a different answer to what does that mean to me? But Halakha says, oh my gosh, here's the verse, and this is the tradition that tells us how the verse should be interpreted and what it means for our obligatory requirements to God. And there's no debate about that because it's the tradition that takes me all the way back to Moses. Okay? Now, he goes on. The redaction of the Mishnah and the establishment of its authority was for the Midrashim a two-edged sword. Okay? Why? On the one hand, it established for the rest of Jewish history the superior status of apodictic law. Apodictic means a law that is self-justifying. Okay? Apodictic means a starting point that comes from logic alone. And in this way, it eclipsed to some extent the study of Midrashic interpretation. In other words, if I have a law that's self-justifying, my views, my opinions about it don't really matter. So it eclipses that. On the other hand, the very existence of an apodictic code makes it necessary for the code itself, its authority and its regulations to be justified in light of the commandments of the Torah. To put otherwise, the existence of this digest of oral Torah led to a renewed need to demonstrate the nexus of oral and written laws. Okay? And what's the nexus of oral and written laws? Moses, Sinai. There was now a need to show that the two were in reality one. And this indeed was the main agenda of Taniatic Midrashim. Their purpose, they understood the process really well. the process is, who gives you the right to tell me that I should live like this? Okay? I understand the law from Moses. It's written down. But who is going to tell me what that means in my particular circumstances? And of course, the Tanaim said, but Moses already told you, because the oral law that we're giving you comes from the same place as the written law, right? The two are the same. They're not different. They both come from the same authority, okay? Now, we're going to leave that idea behind and go on to what happens later. Now, remember, we're text to tradition, so we're getting into how the tradition changed, okay? So he says, by 350 CE, Constantius II had asserted control over his father's entire realm with the help of, from 351, of Gallus, who administered the East. It was in this period that anti-Jewish legislation was first enacted. Okay, so let's back up. We saw that there were tax revolts and punishments of Jews very early on, 60 to 66. Okay, we saw that there was anti-Semitic propaganda beginning in the second century with the Gentile church. But now what he's saying is there wasn't an empire-wide legitimate anti-Jewish legislation until 350. Yeah, 275 years after the end of the apostolic age. At this point, by 350, remember Constantinople, all that kind of stuff's already happened. Jews were to be isolated from Christians and penalties for converting Gentiles were strengthened. In other words, by 350, there was a complete separation of Judaism and Christianity, and Christianity had been adopted by the Roman Empire and therefore became the state religion. Okay? He goes on, in the years 451 to 527, saw Christians engaged in internal struggles over religious matters. What were the internal struggles over religious matters between 451 and 527? Do you know what they were? I can tell you one of them. The Trinity was a huge internal struggle in Christianity and separated the church, actually split the church in two, okay? But the emperors were involved, the bishops were involved, it had all kinds of political ramifications. It wasn't settled until that period, 451 to 520, okay? And their political repercussions, or perhaps we should say the political struggles expressed through religious conflicts. So here's what's happening. Remember, by now, the church is literally the state religion. And what happens in the church affects a political empire. So the emperor gets involved, the bishops, the archbishops, they're all, you know, cozying up to one emperor after another to get him to approve their theological views. And the theological views of the church become the political instruments of the empire. So all kinds of mixture is going on here. Now, what happens? When the Arabs conquered Mesopotamia in 634 CE, they were well received by the Jews, and a completely new chapter in Jewish history was opened. Why did the Jews accept the Arabs in 634 with open arms? Why? It's real simple. They accepted Islam because the church was persecuting them, right? They fled the persecution of the church and embraced Islam because Islam was kicking the church out of North Africa, right? The enemy of my enemy is my friend. So as far as they're concerned, it's better to have Islam on my doorstep because they're getting rid of the people who are killing me that claim to be Christians, right? That's what happened. And in fact, if you read, there's another book here. I can't remember the author at the moment. But what he argues is that the church is responsible for the uprising of Islam and Islam's ultimate hatred against Jews. The church is responsible for that, because had the church not engaged in this anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish warfare for 400 years, Islam never would have gained a foothold in the world. Right? Okay. If one purchases a volume of the Talmud, it will include the Gemara as well as the Mishnah. Yet, in fact, this use of the word Gemara is very recent. Medieval Christian censors replaced the earlier term Talmud, which had become objectionable to them, with Gemara. And only later did the term Talmud begin to designate the combination of the Mishnah and the Gemara. Right? That's important because I can send you to a website where you can download for free the entire Babylonian Talmud. And you will get all of these pieces. The Mishnah, the Gemara, all that kind of stuff comes with it, right? Okay? But today, when we talk about the Talmud, we include Gemara. But in the Middle Ages, Christianity actually separated those things. Okay, now why is that important? Because look what he says next. The main activity of Talmud was the resolution of contradictions in Tanaitic materials. Why were there contradictions in Tanaitic materials? Because the oral Torah and the written Torah don't always match up. And now in Tanaitic Judaism, they all come from the same source, God through Moses. So there can't be any contradictions. So I've got to spend my time figuring out how to resolve those issues. Okay? All right. Let's go on. Inquiry into the scriptural source or proof texting of a particular rule is another important aspect of Amoraic analysis. This is the period of time following the end of the Tanaitic period. So this is from 200 CE on. Okay, a new approach. By the way, Amoraic means interpreters. So Tanaitic is teachers, and Amoraic is interpreters. The Mishnah, virtually devoid of biblical proof texts, had separated the law from its biblical origins. The Amoren and the later redactors of the halakhic Midrashim sought to reintegrate law and scripture so as to demonstrate that the written and oral laws constituted one unified revelation from God. Okay? So I want you to understand the picture. In the first century, there is no contention between the oral law and the written law because the oral law is tradition. It's just how we do things, okay? But by the time you get to 200 CE and Judah the Prince, the Talmud becomes the means by which we really understand what God said to Moses at Sinai. And for the next 1,000 years, in Judaism, that issue, how do I resolve oral and written law, becomes the most important thing that's going on at a theological level in the Jewish community, right? I have to figure out a way to get these things to say the same thing because they came from the same God through the same prophet Moses, okay? So my focus is going to be on making sure that I resolve all the potential disagreements or conflicts or contradictions. And obviously that's what he says, to reintegrate law and scripture, to reintegrate what I understand as the traditions now codified and the written Tanakh. Okay? Just some other comments that he makes about what happens during this period. No fixed prayer collections are known to have existed in Talmudic times. Now we're talking about the Siddur, right? Although there was a basic sequence of obligatory prayers, the text of the liturgy had not yet been standardized, but different versions of various prayers were available, and some of these had attained written form in private notes. Okay? So what is he saying? Today we have this, the Siddur. Right? The standard liturgy of Jewish worship. Look what he just said. That didn't exist in Talmudic times. Right? In other words, this standard liturgy is developed after the Tanaim, after Judah the Prince. Now all these prayers are collected, and by the way, written down so that they become standardized, right? Look, you see the pattern? The pattern is really simple. The experience of God is flexible. It's ambiguous. It's what God does in the event and how I experience it. What happens? We start to make it the same for everyone, right? We write it down. We standardize it. We teach it in standard ways. We expect everyone to believe the same thing. It doesn't matter if it's Christian or it's Jewish. It goes through this process of becoming more and more rigid as it goes along because people can't just believe whatever they want, right? You think about Erev Shabbat, okay? Did you know that until a particular rabbi came to Sfat in Israel, Erev Shabbat was whatever the local community was doing on the eve of Shabbat. Okay? But he got quite concerned that there were many different varieties of what you would do on Erev Shabbat. So guess what? He standardized it, and now we have lighting of the candles, saying of the prayers, all that. Where did that come from? It came from a Kabbalistic rabbi in Sfat about 300 years ago. But now it's so standard that it's done all over the world. And we don't think, oh, where did that idea come from? Just like we don't ask, where did these prayers come from, right? Or where did the Talmud come from? We think it's always been like that. And that's Schiffman's point, that these ideas came from someplace. They weren't just always there. But once they arrived, people who developed the ideas looked for a way to justify their authority by reaching back into the past and making them sound like they came from, in this case, Moses. Right?
It makes you wonder, because I always worry, am I doing something right? Am I doing it wrong? Is God going to be mad at me? And then you wonder, well, maybe God had nothing to do with all that, so maybe he's not as concerned about if you're doing it correctly right.
Yeah, okay, so in the end, my answer to that comment, a good comment, my answer would be, what did Abraham do? I mean, you know, Abraham's the guy. He's the one that God says, okay, we're going to start with you. And I don't see a liturgy from Abraham. I don't see a prayer sequence from Abraham. I don't see a particular way of handling the meal from Abraham. I don't see any of that stuff. And yet, God chooses Abraham, right?
But then
so
you want to wonder.
Does that tell me that I just have to go back and be like Abraham? No, impossible. I can't be like Abraham. That was, you know, 3,000 years ago. What I have to realize is that it is the natural propensity and tendency of human beings to want everyone to do things the same way. And that's what we see. The development, as what Schiffman is pointing out, is from text to tradition, is how do you go from this experience with God into a standardized way of doing things and a standardized way of believing things, right? Well, I mean, are you surprised? Look at what's happening in the world today. Everyone must do the things exactly the same way. Everyone in the entire world must follow this program. And it's laid out. It's the inhuman inevitability, right?
But in some ways, it feels good to know that you're doing something that everybody around the world that's like you is doing at the same time. So it's kind of a community thing. But then in some ways you think, oh my God, well, if I miss lighting the candle at this time, or if I miss doing whatever, or if I do something, or if I have to do something and I can't do it, then you start to, you know, convince yourself you're going to go to hell or something, you know.
In Judaism, it's really, you've got a really good point there in the fact that you can walk into pretty much any synagogue and feel comfortable. And I just wrote that the siddurs are different depending on Reform, Conservative, whatever, and they constantly being revised across the board with standard prayers. The Amidah is always the same. But in your case, in the comment that you made about going across the board, because I've been in multiple countries, and on Friday, I was on my way home and there is an Orthodox synagogue I walked into. albeit they were split, the men are downstairs in this case, the women were upstairs, but the prayers were the same. I could follow the service. It's more Orthodox and, you know, but that's a good feeling that you can walk into a place and feel like this is home.
Yeah, whatever. But Lindy, that it's a good feeling to belong to a tradition, but that's right. Different than saying this is what God told Moses to do. And that's where we really, that's where the real problem is. It's not a problem with the Tanaim saying, okay, we're going to include these traditions because we want people to feel comfortable and we want them to feel at home and we want them to feel that they belong, right? Good. Perfect. But then to say, this was given to Moses by God in the oral tradition and this is the way you must do it because this is what God had in mind. That's a step that's much further down the road than just being like, oh, this is how we do things.
And that just that point is addressed in whether you are in the whichever where you are. Because,
let's continue.
Anyway,
this is how we're going to make the step into the next question, into the next book, which is about divine law. What is divine law? How does it work? Where did it come from? Right? So let's continue here with Schiffman. He says, when values and customs of an era in which the Talmud developed are taken into account, and especially when the surrounding societies are compared, rabbinic Judaism is certainly seen to have accorded an elevated and respectful status to women. The differing roles assigned by halakha to men and women had their basis in a view which saw male and female as complementary, not competitive, aspects of humanity. In the same way, rabbinic Agadah depicted God in both male and female forms. Why do I want to pick that one up? Well, you know my interest in from Guardian Angel. And here's the point. The separation of men and women in a Jewish Orthodox synagogue doesn't occur until Islam comes into a contact with Judaism. So it happened in the Persian period, or in the Persian period, or the Byzantine period, when Islam began to influence how you separate men and women. Okay? So
that's interesting.
Let's continue. 8th century. It happens in the 8th century. Okay? Before the 8th century, and if you've been to Israel, you know this, before the 8th century, the synagogues didn't have separate areas for men and women. They're just all together in one circular bench, right? Okay, let's continue. Man becomes God's partner in creation and the perfection of the world. Okay, so this, and the reason I included that is because of the influence on what is designated as proper on Shabbat. Creative labors, since they were designated melakha, and melakha is prohibited on Shabbat by Torah, right? What that means is you're not allowed to do any creative things, right? It's the work of that results in a creation of something that's prohibited. Not all work, not all energy, not all giving forth of any kind of effort at all, right? So let's continue. The Shabbat provided a sanctuary and time from everyday work activities and created an atmosphere of sanctity in home and family. And guess what? That's a good thing. The question is, where did that idea come from? Right? And of course, in Orthodox Judaism, we'll read it all the way back into Exodus and in Deuteronomy and all the way back to creation itself. But the development of what happens around Shabbat in the Talmud, there are long tractates about all the things that you can't do and cannot do and what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And all of that comes out of the oral Torah traditions. Okay. After the destruction of the Second Temple, he says, the Seder becomes a central part of the home ritual. That's this. After the destruction of the Second Temple. So sometime during the time when all this oral tradition is being written down, they're also standardizing the liturgy. As distinct from Christianity, he goes on, this approach to sanctification argued that man's physical needs and their satisfaction were inherently good, requiring for their fulfillment and sanctification only that the appropriate laws and regulations be observed. Why is that statement so important? Because of the very first four words, as distinct from Christianity, right? In other words, Christianity taught via Augustine, Aquinas, Luther, and Calvin that the physical needs of man and his satisfactions were not inherently good, that they were the temptation that would lead a man to disobey and end up in hell. So from a Jewish perspective, life today is essential, wonderful, and blessed. From a Christian perspective, life today is the thing that's preventing you from getting to heaven, right? It's the Platonic idea that what really matters is the spiritual world, not the material world. That's not a Jewish idea. That's not a biblical idea, okay? So along comes Christianity and reinterprets Paul as a Platonist. And as a result of that, follows the Platonic dualism between spiritual and material, which you don't find in the, certainly don't find in the Tanakh, and you don't find it in the apostolic writings as far as I'm concerned. He goes on, the most significant example of the transition from temple to non-temple Judaism is that of Torah study. Did you get that? When the temple is destroyed, the religion shifts from worship to study. In fact, it considers study an act of worship. For the rabbis, study replaced sacrifice as a form of worship alongside prayer. Once sacrifice and other temple-centered rituals were no longer possible, study gradually became an act of worship. Okay? Let's continue. The ever-expanding developing nature of the oral law. Did you get that? The ever-expanding developing nature of the oral law. Remember what Aykroyd said? Legal casuistry. That is the natural tendency for law to expand, to add more and more, right? Attracted the best minds, leaving the written Torah to serve as a subject of elementary instruction, midrashic exegesis, and technical grammatical study by a select few. By the Amoraic period, this is following 200 BCE, or BE, sorry, following 200 CE, the rabbis were openly asserting the superiority of the oral law. And so it was natural that the Mishnah became the central teaching to be studied. When the Amoraic community, in the form of the Talmuds, became available, this material became the new scripture of Judaism, and the authority of the Bible was now defined in terms of how it was interpreted in rabbinic tradition. Scripture had been replaced by Talmud. That's a pretty powerful statement from Schiffman. Because, and you know, my observation is that it's true. When Rabbi Zev tells me in the yeshiva they studied the Talmud, not the Torah, I want to throw up my hands and say, yeah, but God gave the Torah. And his answer would be, of course, but God gave the Talmud as well. Right? Okay. The ascendancy, here it is. The ascendancy of the rabbinical authorities of Babylonia. This development dated from the Arab, did you get that? Dated from the Arab conquest in 634 CE and the establishment of the caliphate in Baghdad, which initially ruled virtually the entire Islamic world, including most of world Jewry, and continued to hold considerable sway even after the territorial fragmentation of Islam. And by the way, you would know this if you read a guy like Maimonides. Maimonides writes in 1100 and something, 400 or 500 years after the Arab conquest. And guess what he is? He's a doctor to the caliphate and given free sway to write about Jewish things, okay? As residents of the heartland of a powerful empire, the Jews of Babylonia enjoyed a high degree of prestige, prosperity, and influence compared to their fellow Jews in other countries. In Europe, they're being killed. In Islam, they're being honored. As a result, the foremost Babylonian rabbis, known as Geonim, eminences, soon became the de facto chief rabbis of world Jewry, wielding the authority of the state to enforce rabbinic law and spread the Babylonian Talmud. This development led to the hegemony of the Babylonian Talmud, which later thereafter was the Talmud par excellence and the basis of all later development in Talmudic law and thought. The ascendancy of the Babylonian Talmud as the final source of authority marks the tradition from the close of late antiquity to the onset of the Middle Ages. Did you get that? So It's not what happens in Jewish thought and Jewish history is not a resurgence of the Mosaic law. It's not a reestablishment of the sacrifices. It's not the, you know, the view of a messianic return. You know what it is? It's the priority of the Babylonian Talmud. It's the superiority of the Babylonian Talmud over all other Jewish literature that basically brings Judaism out of antiquity and into the Middle Ages. As he says, post-biblical Judaism had finally reached a consensus. And the consensus they reach is the Babylonian Talmud takes precedence. The final citation, this unity tolerated within itself the debate and the dialectic of Talmudic literature. This openness to debate allowed for the development of an interpretation of Judaism for each new generation. Did you get that? There's the flexibility you have for a religion to survive. This adaptation of Talmudic law and thought to later circumstances was the genius of the rabbis who study and taught the Torah of Israel. It was the rabbis of the Talmud who ensured that its message, supposed to be its message, would continue to resonate among the Jewish people until the present day. So there you have it. The shift from text to tradition is the shift from the Mosaic written law to the Talmudic version of the interpretation of the oral law. And that's how that happened. Okay? Now, the next time that we get together, we're going to ask, okay, if that shift occurred, then what makes the law divine? And that's the next really important linchpin in this development. Okay, so we'll pick up Christine Hay's book the next time, and I think you're going to find it really, really powerful because it sets the difference between our Greco-Roman paradigm and the Talmudic Jewish Middle Ages paradigm that they still live with today.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, when did the Jews and the Islamic people start to have problems?
Ah, isn't that interesting? We'll have to look at that. Well, that's a really good question. Hang on to it. Because you can see that for the first 500 years, from 634 until at least 1200, Maimonides, there wasn't a problem. Right? Something happened along the way. We'll have to find out what that was. Any other questions? Any other comments about, we're finishing Schiffman now. So if you don't understand something, we need to make sure that you got it because. Yes. Larry.
Hey, yes. Good morning. Hey, first of all, I'd like to make a comment that supports some of the, what we talked about today, which is that Mariana Dacey in her thesis writes about the history of separation of Christianity and Judaism, where she does study to find out that the first 15 or 16 bishops of Christianity were actually Jewish. So I didn't want to interrupt you while you were in that portion of it, but I thought that was, yep. I mean, it fits right into what of the right. Of his writing, right?
Yeah, so, and there's a really good collection of work by historians called The Ways That Never Parted. It's a bunch of historians in a collected volume of papers. And one of the arguments is that Messianic Judaism, with a full embrace of the Torah, continued until about the 5th century before it was stamped out by the church, by the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, the next thing I'd like to say is I've been very interested in doing a study similar to this. And it's interesting that you mentioned what did Abraham do? Because I think we eventually, I hope we're going to find that all this is going to tie back into the Melchizedek, right? The king of righteousness, right? Because the king of Salem, which I believe was Shem, son of Noah, I believe that Abraham met him, gave him a tithe. And what happens is that Yeshua ends up being the Melchizedek, which is a king forever, which is what's talked about the kingdomship. And then the last thing I have to say is this. It seems to me that there's a separation of law and faith with Christians. They think there's a difference between law and faith, which I don't agree with. And it seems to me that there's a difference between oral law and written law for the Jewish people. But I believe we're missing something that's in Hebrews chapter 7, where it talks about the Levitical law going away, and it all ties into the Melchizedek, the king of righteousness. So okay. If anybody's interested, read Hebrews 7. To me, that's the answer.
Okay. Somebody else have a comment on this topic before we leave it and get ready for next week?
Actually, I have a question. What was the collection of papers that you were talking about? Is it?
It's an edit. The volume is called The Ways That Never Parted. And I think one of the editors is Adam and somebody. I can't remember now, and I don't have that book on my shelf. It's in my storage unit in Florida. But yes, you want to look at that. The Ways That Never Parted. There are about a dozen or more really world-recognized Hebrew historians who write about this period.
Are you scared?
Where is it? I'll go get it for you.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, David.
Yeah. You were talking, I believe I got this correct, about, you know, what made things authoritative with regards to the Talmud and things like that. Was that basically just that somebody kind of announced themselves as the authority or somehow took that position upon themselves, or
I don't think that that's what happened. I think it's no different than the way that religion works now, right? How did Billy Graham become the authority? Because something happened in the popular movement that began to recognize him as the spokesperson for God when it came to evangelical Christianity. I mean, nobody elected him to that position. Nobody assigned him that position. But some movement occurred where he became more and more recognized to the point that he actually became the spokesman for evangelical Christianity. Okay? The same thing happens in other religious environments and during other religious times, that someone emerges that takes over the populist version of who speaks for my belief. Okay? And it happened that in the first and second centuries, there were many sages involved, many, you know, Jewish academics, but Judah the Prince, whose father was also part of this movement, just rose up out of the ranks as someone that they trusted to do this work, just like we have the same thing happening today. And that's how he had the authority to start writing this stuff down. But listen, here, the most important point of all what Schiffman says is, and you can see it at the end, what is the primary motivation for all of these changes to occur? It's to establish authority. That's it. It's to establish authority, right? The whole purpose of everything that's going on is for the religious population to believe that this is what God wanted. And the only way that that happens is that I have an established authority. The authority can be a person, Yeshua. The authority can be a text, the Tanakh. The authority can be a tradition, now written down the Talmud. But there has to be an authority. And we see the same thing in the Christian church, right? Calvin, Luther, Augustine, Aquinas, Boethius, they all become the authority. Because why? Because people want to know that what they believe is authorized. It's acceptable. It's the thing that I should believe because XYZ tells me, and he knows because that's what God says, right? So it's always a tracing back to authority, right?
But would the same thing then apply to all of what we call the canonization of the New Testament? I mean, during the time of Yeshua, there were believing communities, and none of them had the same beliefs exactly. None of them believed the same text or held them authoritative. It was only after somebody decided to make these authoritative that they became authoritative.
You're exactly right. So what happens, and we see that the same thing happening here, right? Authority leads to standardization. So what it says is, if this man is in the authority or this group is in authority, if this group has the word of God, then what they say becomes the standard and everyone else has to agree to it. Or you're a heretic, you're an outsider. Right? That's just the way it happens. I mean, it happens politically in our world. It happens religiously in our world. It happens in our social world. It happens all the time because it's a human thing. Yes, somebody else.
So Yeshua,
because I've talked about the Book of Enoch, and somebody said that's not canon. I know that. I'm like, oh my.
Yeah, but it's not in our canon because some body, some authoritative body decided it shouldn't be in the canon. It doesn't mean that it wasn't part of the believing community in the first century. It was. Okay.
I understand. So I'm just saying, somebody acted like you can't read it because it's not in the canon. I'm like, oh my goodness.
Right. Someone decided to leave it out. Just like we will discover when we start into the next book, Judah the Prince decided to leave out certain things. He decided what was canonized and what wasn't. Please, you were going to say something?
Well, I was trying to picture Yeshua who comes on the scene, and he's got 200 years behind him of Talmud, right?
Yep.
And oral
in
law.
Oral tradition,
that's
in
being,
the oral tradition, that's right. Orally,
yeah,
it's there.
So he knows this. He's been taught in this. So what's his mission as the authority figure at this point? He's trying to bring people back to the main authority or the original authority, which is God.
Well,
and
actually,
he's fighting against new authority, right?
Yeah, but it's interesting because actually, if you think about what Yeshua talks about as authority, he doesn't talk about God. You know what he talks about? Moses.
Moses, yeah. Moses.
Right. So,
but now
it's
he's
really
fighting against Talmud and oral law.
Yeah, but what's really interesting is this. Yeshua doesn't talk about Moses in terms of the oral tradition. He doesn't say, in the name of this rabbi, in the name of this rabbi, in the name of this rabbi, this is what Moses says. He never says that. What does he say? He says, Moses says, and always it's a reference to the written tradition. Okay? So that you will have to, you know, noodle that a little bit to see, because listen, Yeshua is a product of his age. He clearly knows the oral tradition because there are some debates that he has with the Pharisees that depend on the oral tradition. In fact, some of his parables actually depend on the oral tradition for their proper understanding. Okay? But he never refers to them as the authority. He refers to Moses as the authority.
That he just
that should give us a.
Or is
go ahead. Go ahead, Lise. What were you going to say?
I said that should give
Sally
us.
Sally Clark needs to mute her microphone. There's all kinds of feedback coming through audio.
Go ahead, Lise.
That should give us a hint on what we should be looking to when we're mixed up with all of, you know, like all of Christianity and all of Judaism. I mean, we can get really caught up in the weeds, but I think that should give us a hint of what we're supposed to be looking to, I think.
Yeah, sure. Now all we have to do is understand what in the world Moses said.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that.
Okay, so anybody else before we sign off?
Yes, yeah, Skip. I'm sitting and thinking, well, you know, if you've had a charismania background like what I came through in my early 20s, you think there's a need for somebody to step to the front and say, no, stop all of this because this is getting out of hand. This is what we're going to do now.
Sure. But that's a human propensity when it comes to understanding how God works in community, right? Here, the difference is this, Maddie. In the first century, if you didn't like the way the group was being handled by the rabbi in Caesarea, you'd just pick up and go to the rabbi someplace else, right? It wasn't like there was one standard approach for everyone that everyone had to everyone had to conform to a certain set of prayers, a certain ritual. So even when you went up to the temple, for heaven's sake, how you went in to worship God was a matter of individuality within very wide boundaries, right? Okay? sir, you had to go through a mikvah to get up there. But it doesn't tell you this is what you must say. This is when you should kneel. This is when you should take three steps back, three steps forward. This is when you should, I mean, all that kind of stuff came later. Why? Because people want to belong, and in order to belong, you have to conform. And
that's why we're all here today, because we're all kind of
religion all the time. That's the constant battle of religion, because ultimately your experience of God is personal. It's your experience of God. The question is, how does it fit into the group? And if the group requires you to behave and act and think in a certain kind of way, and you want to belong, then you're pressed to conform. That we're always going to face that. Always. Maybe that's why Abraham was all by himself. He couldn't get along with others. Okay, anybody else? My gosh, what a lively discussion we're going to have. Wait till next week. Oh my gosh, it's going to get much worse, because now we're going to concentrate on what does the law do? How does it function? What is it really about? How is it so different for the Jewish world than it is for the Greco-Roman?
Okay? Hey, Skip, we can't necessarily say that the oral tradition wasn't there during Moses either, right? Because it was been passed down over and over and over, so something was passed down from Moses
to Sinai. That's right. Something was passed down. The question is it believable to think that God instructed Moses about the Shabbat elevator?
No, probably not. Yeah. Yep. That's a little bit too far.
Yes.
I once had the rabbi say that you do is if you follow the fences, then you won't break whatever the law is. I'm not defending because I don't get into a Shabbat elevator unless I have no choice. But he would even say, a Chabad rabbi, he would even say, no, it's not the authoritative, but if you follow it, then you will be careful not to actually don't do what you're not supposed to do, you know, and that's the fences. That's all what it's all about. So,
yep. Skip, you said something about Abraham. It's me, Bonnie. You said something about Abraham, and that's why he was alone, and he didn't want to abide to a lot of these things, I guess. Joking.
That was a joke. Abraham is known for his hospitality. But the fact of the matter is, his experience with God was an individual one, right? He carried that by himself. He didn't belong to a community.
Thank you. Yeah. All along through this whole study, it's exactly how I've been thinking. Keep it simple, because, I mean, it's personal. It is between God and yourself. And I guess you could call me the rebel one, because I don't want to fit, or I just can't seem to fit any longer with everything else that's just so Christian-easy. And it's like, I might as well just stay in community out here in the bush and carry on with my relationship with God, as simple as that. Keep it simple, silly. Because otherwise, I mean, we're knocking against everything and religion. And it's like, for me, it's safer to be out here and having my relationship with God alone.
Yes, with one caveat. And the caveat is that Yeshua, your Messiah and chief rabbi, tells you need to be involved with other people in the world.
Yes. That's good.
Just believe me and follow my instruction and spend your time on the river up there in Quebec. You'll be fine, right? But that's not what he says. What he says is your job is to get involved in the world and bring about restoration. So you can't do that sitting on the river in Quebec. You have to go and get involved with the rest of the world. Right?
Row, row, row my boat.
Yeah, right.
I get it. No, I do walk in that.
Yeah. In other words, the church, many of the church fathers believed what you just said. The only way to survive in a relationship with God is to get away from everybody else. And the church desert fathers did that. They left civilization and they survived as basically cloistered monks. They didn't have any interaction with the rest of the world. Okay. Okay. So we recognize that they said some really powerful things, and you can read about the Desert Fathers, and it's really interesting stuff, but they missed the point. The point is that their Messiah, right, says the job that you have is restoration of God's world, not isolation. So you're forced to go back and deal with all these people in obedience, right? And besides which, human beings are designed for that. You're designed as a communal animal, right?
That's good. Right? Thank you.
Okay. All right. We'll close up, and we will be back next Shabbat, 8 a.m. in the morning on the East Coast. And we'll start with Christine Hayes' book on the law, which I think you're going to find incredibly interesting. Okay, ciao, bye, see ya.